This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Do you know exactly how much of your tax money is spent on streetlights, garbage collection, or any other public infrastructure? The idea of making government data readable and readily available to the public is new, but fast gaining ground. Initiatives around the world are attempting to capitalize on open data to improve governance, encourage civic engagement, and promote economic growth. Two individuals working on such initiatives are Antonio Acuna, head of data.gov.uk, and Michael Canieres, regional research manager at Open Data Lab Jakarta. And part of the initiative that's brought them to our shores is Tricia Yeo, COO at IDEAS, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Firstly, how would you explain what open data is?
Okay, I'd probably start with that one. That's a definitional question. So essentially, we're looking at open data within the context, at least within the context of three major characteristics. So one would be that the data is essentially in machine-readable formats. So by saying machine-readable formats, we're talking about data which can be understood by the computer. So like, for example, when we're talking about the format in itself, we're looking at CSV, for example, or comma-separated value data, rather than PDFs or rather than pictures that are actually not readable by the computer as it is. Then we are also talking about data which is openly licensed. By openly licensed, we are saying that the data essentially can be reused by people who have access to it. And the last one is, when you talk about open data, there's the idea of what we refer to as accessibility. So if, for example, a person would like to get access to the data, either through the web or by other means, there should be no cost of accessing it. So if you'd like, if there's a cost to it, it should be something like just the cost of reproduction of the data.
Yeah. How then is this data turned into something that can be used by NGOs, businesses, and the public?
Well, that's an interesting one. Most of the data that, when we talk about open data, we're actually talking about government data, in principle, the big movement, the momentum at the moment. That is data about the running of the country. That is data about the most fundamental services that we have. When that data is made available without any obstacles to businesses, to individuals, to journalists, the possibilities of bringing it together to derive not only new insights into how things are happening, but to keep a level of accountability towards government and to find new business models based on bringing those things together.
Could you give us an example of how open data has improved governance in the UK as well as in Indonesia?
I can give you an example on the UK, certainly. I think my colleagues here will have to pick up the Indonesia one. But the UK, for example, in terms of services, I'm going to use an example which has been very popular, but I think is still the best, which is the health example. We published as open data all the data about prescriptions. So every single drug prescribed by a doctor in the UK has been released by type, by condition. One type of drug is statins, which are commonly prescribed. And a group of people immediately took that data and began to dig into it and discovered that most doctors prescribe the brand version of the statins, the most expensive version. If they were to shift to the next cheapest version, which is as efficient, it would have been savings of £200 million a year in pounds for the National Health Service, which is now being looked into to see how it can be implemented. So from the point of view of better services, we have seen direct impact on not only being taught and told by others how to make it better, but the services themselves beginning to dig into the data to say, well, hang on a minute, we have a gold mine here about ourselves. So business intelligence is emerging out of that and it's making better services.
Yeah, so I'd probably speak more widely regarding the region. So while Open Data Lab is based in Jakarta, we practically work in Southeast Asia. So in Indonesia, for example, Open Data has made possible the the flow of information regarding budgets from government to citizens, and at the same time, it also made possible the citizens' engagement with government in terms of influencing, for example, the allocation of funds at the village level. So in the city, for example, of Yogyakarta in Indonesia, there's an organization which practically translates data from government into something which can be digested by citizens. Because as you can see, if you talk about budgets, these are sectoral, or shall we say, data that has a specialized context and needs a special kind of expertise, for example, like accountants and finance managers. So this organization essentially takes that data out from government, tells or converts it into a format that can be understood by citizens, disseminates it through both online and offline formats in such a way that citizens can actually say where the money is going, what are the plans for this government for me in this particular year. So whether or not there's a school that needs to be constructed, and if the school has been constructed, then is it something that really needed, and so on. So that's just one of the examples that you can see where open data can actually translate into better transparency and citizen engagement.
Tricia, what relevance do you see for open data in our country in particular?
Thanks so much for having us here. I think coming from IDEAS, Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, we are civil society and we see things on behalf of how citizens participating in decision-making processes, maybe at the local, state or federal government levels. We are actually involved in pushing a number of things, for instance, asking for a more open and transparent budget. And also, the way open data sits in the context of a larger initiative called the Open Government Partnership. We had an event earlier today which talked about OGP, and Malaysia is not yet a signatory to the OGP, primarily because of certain things like not having a Freedom of Information Act, not having a very well-regulated asset declaration system. So in the context of the broader way in which governments can include citizens in that decision-making process, I think that's where we would come in. And of course, from the civil society, we want to show that government has the responsibility to reach out and we can partner with them. And it's not just from a top-down approach, but also from the bottom-up.
Listening to this, it sounds like something that should logically have been made available, you know, a long time ago. It's information that the people should have about how a country is run, about the way tax dollars are being spent and so on. But how did the concept of open data originate and when did it pick up, you know, Antonio, as you mentioned earlier, momentum?
Well, that's interesting. Although there has been for quite a long time, in the last two decades, an involvement from civil society in demanding that, you know, a better relationship with government and in some instances a complete redressing of the relationship between government and citizens. Open data, as we know it now, started actually with Tim Berners-Lee screaming out in at TED conference, raw data now. And basically what Tim Berners-Lee was trying to point was that that data is out there, let us have it. And, you know, let's get this collective mind to actually make the most of it, which, in fact, I think Rufus Pollock, the founder of Open Knowledge Foundation, was the one who actually set that. So it's one of those bizarre connections. But it started from there, and they started really, it resonated with civil society, it resonated with researchers, and with some politicians as well, as a way forward, because facts are very powerful. And the perception was that government tells you what the facts means. If you have the information, you can say, those numbers are wrong. This is right.
Yeah, and I think Antonia is right that these kinds of engagements between citizens and governments, for example, about the budget example that I was mentioning about, is not entirely new. But open data makes it possible to speed up the process, for example, of accessing, reusing, and disseminating information. So, for example, like I know that several of organizations in Asia, for example, have been engaged extensively in budget monitoring. But open data actually is a resource, as a tool, made it more... made it more efficient, or shall we say easier, for citizens to access government data and disseminate it in a format that would be useful for citizens. So in the case of Asia, for example, much of it, in the countries of Indonesia and the Philippines, for example, much of the advances in open government data happened when both countries signed up as one of the 8 pioneer countries in the Open Government Partnership from the region. And Indonesia for once hold a co-chairmanship at some point and did an event last year in Bali about open government in the context of Asia, for example.
Could the both of you tell me briefly about the roles that you hold in your respective organizations? You know, what exactly do you do?
Oh, wow. That's nice of you to ask.
Yes, I know. I should have opened with that.
No, that's fine. Well, in my case, well, I'm the head of DataWorld.gov.uk, which is a data portal, so a site where all government departments and agencies publish the data, and it's a catalogue, basically. So it's a traditional taxonomy structure kind of thing. You want to find things. It's a discovery tool. But it also has a lot of tools to work with local authorities to harvest their data and to move it. It has engagement elements and so forth. And it is the UK government sort of prime point to sustain the agenda. So UK government wants to be the most transparent government in the world. It's doing very well and, you know, hitting the high marks on the list and so forth. But it's a never-ending quest. You know, next year somebody else will may get it. So it's always trying to make sure that you make it business as usual to be the best. And I think everyone can become the best in that sense. I mean, that's a nice goal to have. So the Data Talk of UK sort of, it's that visual calling card for the efforts that we're doing.
Yeah, so Tim Berners-Lee, the one Antonio mentioned, actually founded the Web Foundation, which is an organization, a nonprofit organization that advances the power of the web as power for also for the citizens. So it set up the Open Data Lab in Jakarta as a social innovation lab that tests things on harnessing the value of open data to make improvements in public service delivery, in transparency, as well as in efficiency in government. So at the lab, I'm currently the regional research manager, and we're practically engaging ourselves in action research by looking into what models of engagement, for example, best work in ensuring that open data can be harnessed to serve the demands of and needs of citizens.
I'm speaking today with Antonio Acuña, head of data.gov.uk, and Michael Canyares, regional research manager at Open Data Lab Jakarta, and Tricia Yeo, COO at IDEAS, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. We're discussing open data. Up next, we discuss the value of open data, economic and otherwise. You're listening to Live and Learn today on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me today, Antonio Acuña, head of data.gov.uk, Michael Canyares, Regional Research Manager at Open Data Lab Jakarta, and Tricia Yeo, COO at IDEAS. We're discussing open data. Antonio, the estimated economic potential of open data in the UK is £16 billion. How does open data create value?
That's an interesting one. That's an interesting number, because I think every large company out there has come up with their own version. But it's actually, in my opinion, a viable number, if you see what I mean. I mean, it needs to be taken with a grain of salt, but still, it's not out of the picture completely. How it can create that, I mean, we've talked about better services when you start saving billions in running the government, for example. For one, you're saving, you're contributing toward that. When you start having companies coming up with very specific business models for very specific problems in government services and local services, you start it also producing that value, both from the tax revenues and from the employment and growth. And when you get partnerships between government and civil society, for example, to identify what really are the things that need to be tackled, and you then get other companies with different models, startups, not necessarily the large traditional corporate structures, but new structures being explored, and you get them involved, that also generates value. And in the process as well, some products will be made, applications, services, whatever, that may hit it big in today's world and also contribute to that. But it's that foundation that has the power to not only save money, but create wealth.
Michael, Tricia, do you think that in terms of infrastructure and economy, we're set up here in Southeast Asia for the same sort of growth and value that the United Kingdom appears to be ready for?
Okay, so I'd probably start off, Tricia, with that difficult question.
You go for it.
So you were talking about infrastructure, right? So do we have the technological infrastructure to be able to harness the power of data, for example? You're talking about a region with slow broadband connection, and where internet penetration is also significantly low in other contexts. So whether or not that's possible, I think I would argue on the affirmative side. So that's why in Asia, and in the work of, in our work in developing countries in Latin America as well as in Africa, where we are also doing a lot of research and innovation projects, we are actually saying that there's a need for intermediaries to be able to translate the power of open data into something that can be accessed both online and offline. So, which means we're actually saying, for example, that in the discussion on open data, no one should be left behind. So, for example, in projects in the Philippines and Indonesia, we're looking at translating open data, which comes from an online source, essentially, into something that can be digested by people that are not, or communities that are not connected. So, we are saying, for example, that print is not yet dead, which means, for example, that if we have data, for example, and then we convert it into something useful, we don't just use the normal online channels to promote it and to inform citizens. So we still go back to notice boards. So in the Philippines, they call it periodicate, or something that a periodical that you can just post on a bulletin board. Because these things are actually things that appeal to people still in these unconnected contexts.
I'll probably just speak on behalf of the Malaysian context. I think the question is probably a slightly different one for Malaysia. Malaysia does have the technological infrastructure. You know, from the government's perspective, they've already tried to have a very, very high internet, and not just internet, but broadband penetration rate. We're targeting by 2020, for instance, to go far beyond the 80% broadband penetration rate. So in terms of the infrastructure, we're already there. I think the right question for Malaysia, though, is whether or not the people in leadership, whether it's to do with in government or in businesses, whether they're ready to take on this challenge of using open data to create value for themselves. We have seen several companies in Malaysia who have been able to do that. Earlier on, again, I mentioned in the event, we had, for instance, the company GrabTaxi, which is a Malaysian-born company, which is now being able to use the data sources and information that they have to work with government to provide, say, perhaps traffic information. And there are so many other examples that we can learn from in the region and from the UK, where perhaps local councils could bring in citizens to put in information on crime data, on the problems that they're facing in roads and traffic lights. You know, people complain all the time about your longkang issues and your potholes. So I think there's definitely the framework to be able to do that. But the cultural mindset change really needs to be there. In Malaysia, we do have MDEC, for instance, leading the way with data.gov.my. But that's just the first stage. How about moving forward, creating even more value? And that's where education comes in.
I just wanted to probably echo strongly your point about this is not a technology thing. It so happens that the easiest way to give universal access is online. Mm. This is about opening up data that the taxpayer already paid for. So it's a mindset change, it's a cultural change that happens to be aided heavily by technology, but it shouldn't be an excuse not to be open.
Mm. Yeah, I definitely agree.
What particularly stands in the way of turning public government data into open data?
So for most of the countries in the region that we've worked with, it's actually the apprehension that the data will be used for something else, or the data will be used inappropriately, or the data will be used against government leadership. So, and the other reason actually that that we see as also a blockage in that in the direction of more openness is the fact that the governments also within the region are also grappling with data quality. So, if you have problems with the quality of your data, then you might. I'm not saying there's a correlation there, but somehow you might be potentially apprehensive in putting that out. Because if you put that out, then it's up to question. Yeah. And it's up to discussion. And people will see that this data is not good or this data is not correct. So take, for example, if you have a Department of Public Works and Highways saying that these roads have already been completed. And then you put out the data out into the open and then people are saying, where's the road? We haven't seen it. So, I mean, like, so the data quality issue is also one thing. I think these are the two most pressing concerns for governments.
Antonio, earlier you mentioned that the UK wants to be the most open government in the world. Why has that I would imagine that for many years that would not have been the traditional mindset of government. I mean, certainly not the mindset of government in our region by and large. So what has prompted that mindset change, or what's prompted that philosophy?
Well, a mixture of things. One was, at first, the economic value of doing this. Tangentially, of course, the emergence of, we're talking about 2009, 2008, the emergence of, you know, the Google's startup culture and so forth. A new way of looking at the world was coming up. Data was the currency of that world. So it made sense. So the first shift was a benefit shift. Okay, there's an economic value here, and it's just cool and good. To be honest, as that evolved, then suddenly the realization of the whole game is changing. You know, we cannot subsist as a government going forward without changing, because the people are changing, the needs are changing, the mentality is changing. So, and technology is forcing some of that change. So the same way the UK government is working heavily on digital transformation, openness published by default, open by default, became the paragons of, if we don't do this, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to have to function at this level now. So it's sort of a preempting that.
How is big data different from open data?
I'm going to get into trouble for this. Big data, the name itself is a bit of an invention. It's a PR invention from companies that want to sell you a lot of services. We've always had big data. If you go back to census in Malaysia, whenever, 20, 30, 40 years ago, that's big data. Governments and entities have always handled large volumes of data.
Population data is big data.
Precisely. Yeah. So it's nothing new. It is increasing rapidly, definitely. So the velocity is there. The volume is there. The value has always been there, because there was a good reason why we captured it in the first place. It's the velocity that has prompted the idea of big data, meaning it's so large, it grows so fast, we can handle it, we can control it. We need some sort of way in which we can tackle all of this, bring it together, and derive some business intelligence from it. I prefer to talk about data science. I prefer to talk about the tradition of handling, you know, looking at data and deriving benefits and insight from data. Open data, it's simply a licensing, if you think about it, licensing terms. It's data that has no conditions, is in an open format, and that has some value. So they are the same thing. One is a licensing attribute of the data. The other is a term that defines large volumes of it that grow at a very, very, very high rate.
There is some pushback to open data, though, because of poor anonymization standards, which in turn raises privacy concerns. What are your thoughts on these criticisms?
I think the conversation on open data should also bring with it the conversation on data privacy. So you're right about saying that there are a lot of data that needs to be anonymized. So talk about health data, for example. There's certain degree of anonymization that's required there. So that conversation is currently ongoing, and I haven't seen any end to that yet. But I think the goal essentially for privacy is to make sure that data isn't actually used to compromise certain people and certain minorities, for example, if you like.
I agree. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, the best example ever given to me about that issue was a heart surgery. It's tricky, and the heart may stop, but you still have to operate. So you can still operate without stopping the heart. You know what I mean? There are things you can do to continue going forward, to be more open, and still protect and be responsible for privacy and any impacts that it may cause, especially when you're talking about children, you know, schools and things like that, or patients, for example, vulnerable people. There's no reason why you couldn't be open all the way while being responsible and intelligent about handling those elements.
It's proceeding with an understanding of risk, in other words.
Yeah. Simple.
Okay. And I think also in the UK, there are existing privacy laws that would you know, mitigate for these concerns, which perhaps we need to ensure those regulations are similarly strong in the region. So I don't know whether you could talk about the UK example as well.
That's true.
Yeah, I would just like to add very quickly on what Antonio was saying. Like, if you say that privacy will be the hindrance for openness, or if you use privacy, for example, as an excuse not to open the data, then I think that argument is entirely misplaced in the conversation.
Yeah. No, I agree. And the UK, yes, we have the Data Protection Act, for example. And we have other type of protection in legislation that avoids even departments sharing the data between themselves, for example. But the important thing is that when you, as you say, when you talk about anonymization as not even a hindrance, but the obstacle, the stop, okay, what you're saying is that a 1% will dominate the rest. Because most of the time, there will be 1 or 2% situations, you know, elements of the data that present a risk. The rest doesn't. Mm-hmm. You deal with those 2%. You don't lock up the rest just because you don't know what to do with that 2%.
Yeah.
You just go with it.
Discerning that 2%, would that fall to the job of a person? Would it fall to the job of a system? How are we sifting through to find that 1% or 2% that require protection, that require, you know, screening for vulnerability?
I'll say people. Mm. Especially when you're talking about vulnerable people, you know, vulnerable children in schools and so forth and so on. I think that the human aspect would always be necessary. There may be markers where you can have intelligent systems that look, but I would be far more comfortable if there was an aspect of human assessment. Yeah. It's a life, after all, that we're trying to protect.
And there's also the question whether there's public value in disclosing that data. Yeah, well. So, I mean, if there's no public value, then you might as well anonymize things.
Yeah. Which leads me to my next question, which is whether big databases can be kept both anonymous and useful. How much specific information might you need to have in order for the data to be, you know, to be directly understandable and useful and contextualized?
So if you talk about the health data that I was talking about a while ago, do you really need names, for example, to be able to decide on what policies on health would you like to implement or to legislate, for example? I don't think so. So, but do you need ages, for example,
and profile, gender.
Gender, for example, to do that? So I think I don't think that the process is counterintuitive. So I think there are certain data that you can actually completely anonymize because you don't actually need it to do something about it. But there are things, for example, that are very helpful for you to be able to know so that you'll be able to get an action on things.
Yeah. It's a bit difficult when you think in terms of the public value is important. You will always run the risk of linking things up, all right? When you start talking about 60 million people in the record and things like that, even if you take names out, even if you take all sort of markers, there will be a way that one or two will be identified. But so can I do it if I go down to the registers and find birth registers and marriage registers and things like that. If I'm very good, I could probably find out a lot about you just by doing through the legal means, Okay. So the reality is we already live with that risk. That risk will continue. That shouldn't stop the conversation.
Which is why I suppose the conversation about privacy needs, as you all have said, to be ongoing and to
in
continue.
Tandem with it, as part of, intrinsic part of it.
Can you provide an example of how making government data public can spur innovation? I mean, we've talked about how it can save money, we've talked about how it can bring value, but how would it in turn spur innovation?
Okay, so I'd probably talk about one example in the Philippines when the government, the Department of Transportation actually had a hackathon on transport data, which actually spurred the creation of what they call a Sakay.ph, which is a platform which helps commuters, for example, to find the best ways of going from one place to the other. And there is also what they refer to as there's a Sari.ph, which also talks about data for micro entrepreneurs and what they call a sari-sari stores, small micro entrepreneurs, and how they can be connected through a supply chain process. And this practically is done by a group of tech geeks that has a good understanding of the context and the problem.
In the UK, I mean, we have, but DataGov UK has listed about 300 something apps and services made with open data. But again, we run the risk sometimes of simplifying the process. Sometimes open data is just one of the elements for innovation, but a crucial one. Without it, it wouldn't happen, but it's not in itself the innovative element, if you see what I mean.
It's providing people the context and information with which to innovate, I suppose.
Precisely.
Okay. What are the shortcomings of current open data initiatives as they exist? You know, not looking too far ahead, but right now.
Okay, so I'd probably start with that one. So one is, first, it's essentially supply-driven. So which means most of the efforts are actually done to put the data out into the open without necessarily looking to how to engage with the public, for example, with that data, or how to promote reuse, for example. So a lot of the things that have also been done for eliciting use cases is through hackathons and scrapathons or whatever you call it. So, but which actually only appeals to one portion of the population. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges. And only very few organizations, I think, are working on the demand side of open data, making sure, for example, that what government is actually putting out into the open is actually used. So I think that's one major challenge that countries in the region, for example, has to contend with.
I will tend to agree. And I mean, I find Hack Days a lovely experience for people, but not necessarily conducive to any changes in open data whatsoever. Yeah. Or does a Hack Day does not an open government make? Let's put it that way. I think the biggest shortcoming is dogma. Okay, as the press picks it up, as government picks it up, as it gets a bit politicized. Okay, the benefits, the economic benefits, are mentioned. A whole series of things are mentioned. The very basic power of change, the very basic rewriting of the social contract between government and citizens, where sincerity, or an element of sincerity, I'll give you how much I spend, I'll give you the names of the people spending, you know, and you will do something with it, and you will keep me up to date, and you will keep me on my toes. All of that rewriting, that's not being really understood. I mean, it's understood by people, but it's not in the narrative necessarily. And the biggest power of open data is the change it enacts. The fact that you become open, the fact that we're talking here, Malaysia is putting data out, that by itself is the biggest thing you could have hoped for.
Trisha, do you think we're ready for all this?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here, right?
I know.
Well, earlier today, Antonio actually shared that in the UK, how the government has used open data as an example is where all of its public servants' salaries are actually published and available, made for public availability. And it's not just the salaries, it's also their names. So if I wanted to check on how much he earns, I could actually do that just by doing a quick search. So that really got me asking that question as well. Are we actually ready for that? I think that we will be ready because entrepreneurs and the private sector are already running far ahead. They would probably push us into a corner. Government would have to react. There won't be a choice. At the end of the day, it's really because citizens are demanding for it. I think some parts of government are ready. So your MDEC and even MAMPU, these are government agencies that are pushing. But some of the other agencies, like the Ministry of Finance, even Ministry of Education or Defence especially, these are ministries that would need to be educated such that information and providing information is not the exception, but the rule.
Thank you all very much for joining me today. I've been speaking with Trisha Yeo, COO of Ideas, Antonio Acuna, head of data.gov.uk, and Michael Canaris, Regional Research Manager at Open Data Lab Jakarta. We have been discussing open data. You've been listening to Live and Learn today on The Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.